Yeah, so Genesis chapter 39. So if you remember back in Genesis chapter 37, we learned that Joseph had two dreams which revealed God's plan for his future. Both of those dreams indicated that he would someday rule over his family. So imagine for a moment if God had revealed to you and I exactly what our future held. Basically showed up in a dream to us or audibly, and he told us exactly where he was going to take us, what our future would be. And then things go sideways. What would you do? What would you think? How might you respond to that? What might happen to your faith? I've known people who, and I've never had the experience of God audibly speaking to me, or even I've had times where I've had a pretty good idea what I think God wanted, you know, directions in my life where I was pretty convinced he wanted me to do something, but never quite like Joseph had, where it was this black and white sort of, you're going to rule someday. I know people who have claimed to experience that, and when things went sideways, began to question and wonder. You know, what went wrong? What happened? This is God's destiny for me. It's not happening. And I wonder sometimes what Joseph might have been thinking in his case. We're looking at Genesis chapter 39 this morning. And so far, we've seen that things have not gone as they really, what we might have expected with Joseph. You know, to get these dreams that he's supposed to rule over his family. And yet, every step of the way, things kind of go sideways. And yet, as we look at Joseph's life, it doesn't appear to have affected him a whole lot. What I mean, not that he didn't care or didn't wonder. We don't get in his head, really. It doesn't really reveal to us what he might have been thinking with some of the things that happened. If you remember, immediately his family began to hate him for what he had revealed in his dreams. They hated him so much that they wanted to kill him. Then they threw him into a pit, thinking that that'll do it. But then they pulled him out of the pit and sold him off to slavery in Egypt. And then he ends up in Potiphar's house, but his life clearly didn't go, and at least from our perspective, the way that you would expect it to go. It's almost like the direct opposite direction. And again, we don't really know what might have been going on in Joseph's head, or what might have been going on emotionally with him. But if we just stop for a moment and put ourselves in his shoes, what might we expect? I don't know about you, but I'd be wondering what's going on. You know, it's one thing to, you know, just wonder about your future and not know where it's going. But it's another thing to kind of have it mapped out and have it not go that direction. Can we agree on that? And so I often wonder what was going on in his head, but we're not given privilege to that. But what we do see here is that he continued to kind of go forward, and he was faithful every step of the way. And so even though we may not know exactly what he might have been struggling with emotionally or psychologically, we get a pretty good impression externally how he handled it. And we're going to sort of see that today. I'm going to break the passage down today into four parts. We're going to see how God caused Joseph to prosper in unfair and unjust circumstances. So we're going to see how God caused him to prosper in his unfair and unjust circumstances. Second, we're going to see Joseph being tempted in those circumstances, but resisting the temptation and staying faithful. We're then going to see him doing the right thing, but it having cost him dearly for doing the right thing. And we're going to see how it kind of goes sideways again. It looks like things are maybe, and then it goes sideways. But then lastly, in spite of the injustice and the unfair circumstances that Joseph faced, we're going to see how God remained faithful to him and ultimately showed him favor once again. So those four things: God causing Joseph to prosper in the unfair circumstances, Joseph being tempted but resisting the temptation, having him pay dearly because of that, and then lastly, that God still remained faithful to Joseph and showed favor to him. So let's look at the first part of that. We're in Genesis chapter 39. Let's read through the first six verses. We're going to see how God caused Joseph to prosper in unfavorable, unfair, or unjust circumstances. Chapter 39, starting in verse 1. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian official of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, so he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Now his master saw that the Lord was with him and how the Lord caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and became his personal servant. And he made him overseer over his house, and all that he owned he put him in charge. It came about that from the time he made him overseer in his house and over all that he owned, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house on account of Joseph. Thus, the Lord's blessings was upon all that he owned, in the house and in the field. So he left everything he owned in Joseph's charge, and with him he did not concern himself with anything except the food which he ate. So after Joseph's brothers sold him to the Ishmaelite traders, they went all the way down to Egypt and they sold him to this Egyptian official named Potiphar. Now Potiphar was the captain of the guard, which means that he was probably an extremely high-ranking official within Egypt. So he was the captain of this guard, he was rather high-ranking. It would appear that he was probably fairly wealthy as well. He had a lot of stuff, not just in his household, but probably fields and crops and flocks, because it mentions Joseph being over that as well. Now, what we know clearly about this is that Joseph was there unjustly and unfairly. He was basically abused by his brothers, thrown into a pit, sold off into slavery. He certainly wasn't there by any account of his own. He was taken there against his will. So we might expect him to protest or to fight back or to whine and complain, to do everything he can. But notice that's void in this text. We don't see any of that in the text. Now, it doesn't mean he didn't feel that way. I don't know what he was feeling, but I would assume, much like us, would have been upset about it. Would have been unhappy. Might have even questioned God. Wait a minute, God, you gave me these dreams, but I'm a slave now? How does this fit into your plan? Because it's like kind of the opposite, Lord, of reigning and ruling. How is this all going to work out? Twice in this passage, though, it says that God explicitly caused him to succeed. What we see Joseph do here in captivity is he faithfully serves Potiphar. He faithfully serves his master, and he does so in a way that God causes him to prosper. Again, twice it says in this text, go back to verses 2 and 3, the Lord was with Joseph. So no matter what Joseph might have thought or might have felt or might have wondered, the Lord was with him, had not abandoned him. So he became a successful man. And he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Now his master saw that the Lord was with him and how the Lord caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. So we see that twice it says that the Lord was with him. It says that the Lord caused him to prosper. It says that multiple times in this text. So much so that Potiphar was actually blessed because of Joseph's work. And so we see him commit himself to his master and to serve the Lord faithfully, even in the unjust, unfair circumstances that he found himself in. I don't know about you, but I think that's pretty remarkable. Some might say, well, he had no other choice. Yeah, but you know how it is. Sometimes we can serve reluctantly, maybe even belligerently. We don't like the circumstances or situation we're in, or we make sure everybody's aware that we're miserable. But the impression we get here is that Joseph sort of put his head down and served his master. And did it with dignity. But it says that the Lord caused him to succeed. Now, I think we have to step back for a moment and understand what that means. It doesn't appear that Joseph gained anything financially from this. It doesn't appear that he became rich. He was serving as a slave. His circumstance, the fact that he was a slave owned by another human being, didn't change. His success was in what he did with his hands. In other words, his service, he was successful in that service. So I don't believe that we can take this to basically read it as he became this prosperous man. And you know, I wondered what would happen if Joseph heard a sermon by Joel Osteen. Your best life now! That's not what we're talking about here. The Lord caused the work of his hands, the things that he did, he caused him to be successful in serving his master. That's a different kind of success, is it not? Because it isn't a me-centered success. It's that I'm successful in what I'm doing for somebody else. There's nothing in the text here that suggests that Joseph became wealthy or got any possessions out of this. Now later on, when he serves the Egyptian Pharaoh, possibly. But not here. So again, we have to clearly understand what this means. That what he committed himself to do, the way that he served, he was successful in the way that he was serving Potiphar. And as a result, that success also went to Potiphar. His work blessed Potiphar. We're told here that the Lord blessed Potiphar's house because of Joseph. That's what it means for Joseph to be successful. That's a whole different side of success for us. We often think of success as being financial rewards, big house, nice car, you know, a lot of stuff. That's what we determine somebody to be successful, right? We oftentimes don't simply look at them as, boy, they're successful at what they do because of the way they serve. We look at it as to what's accumulated or what they're given because of that service. But this was very different for Joseph. Look at verse 3 again. It says that he saw that the Lord was with him. Now, this is probably the greatest part of Joseph's success, was what Potiphar saw in Joseph. Isn't this interesting? Go back to verse 3. It says that Potiphar saw that the Lord was with him, and he saw how the Lord caused all that he did to prosper. That was a sign of Joseph's success. Potiphar looking at him and realizing that comes from the Lord. He's successful. What he does, he's good at it because of the Lord. The Lord is causing him to prosper. Verse 4 tells us that Joseph found favor in his sight. So he earned the favor of Potiphar here. So much so that he became his personal servant. More literally it reads, found favor in his sight and was serving or ministering to him. So he was serving or ministering to Potiphar. So Potiphar not only made him overseer or manager of his household, but says that he entrusted everything he owned to him. Everything except one thing, the food that he ate. We could speculate why that might have been. There was a concern in the Middle East sometimes with kings and high-ranking officials that their food could be poisoned. So they had people that would test it. That's what the cupbearer primarily, his responsibility was to drink the wine first before he gave it to the king, because if there's poison in it, the cupbearer would fall over dead. How'd you like that job? So that's probably what's alluded to here, that the only thing he concerned himself in his whole entire household, and he says even in his field, all his flocks, Joseph was put over all of that because the Potiphar saw God is with him and God causes everything he does to be a success. And so that's what we're told. So he only concerned himself with the food that he ate. So what do we make of that as we think about this? I've already sort of alluded to it, but it's God can cause us to succeed at whatever we do, even in situations or circumstances that are unfair or unjust. Because again, we can't lose sight of the fact that Joseph's in an unjust, an unrighteous, an unfair, an unfavorable circumstance. He's a slave, taken from his family and is now a slave. And again, we have to look at it from the perspective of the foundation of Israel. I mean, God's got bigger plans for Joseph. And it has to do with redemption of all of mankind. So in many respects, he's a prince who's become a slave. Remember we talked about how Joseph sort of is a type of Christ and foreshadows Christ? And that's what we kind of see here. And so he's in these circumstances, and yet even in such circumstances, he succeeds. Why? Because the Lord is with him and is causing him to prosper, even in those situations. But we can't forget Joseph's role in that. He committed himself to that. He chose to minister, it says. Because again, that phrase, he became his personal assistant, literally is he ministered to him. So Joseph, in those unrighteous and unjust and unfair circumstances, chose to serve the Lord and to serve Potiphar and allow God to make him a success in doing that, in spite of the circumstances. So oftentimes, I think we get it backwards because we think that the circumstances determine our success. If only my circumstances would change. If only God would do this. Or when we are treated unfairly or we end up in a situation where maybe we're being mistreated or maybe we're not getting the recognition we deserve or whatever it is. How can God use this? You know? Circumstances really, in many respects, don't play a role in it ultimately when we're dealing with God. God can cause us to be a success, but in part, we have to allow Him to do that. You know, we're all familiar with Proverbs 3, 5, and 6, trust in the Lord with all your heart, lean not on your own understanding in all your ways, you know, right? But do you ever go back and really look at the context of that passage? Go back to Proverbs chapter 3. There's some interesting things in Proverbs 3. But Proverbs 3, we're going to read just 12 verses from that. But Proverbs chapter 3, starting at verse 1. It says, "My son, do not forget my teaching, but let your heart keep my commandments." So it starts with just keeping the Lord's commandments, doing what He says. "For length of days and years of life and peace, they will add to you." What? What'll add to that? Well, obeying God's commandments will add peace and life, etc., to your life. "Do not let kindness and truth leave you." Think about Joseph for a moment. Do not let kindness and truth leave you. What if he would have let kindness and truth leave him? I would argue that he probably served Potiphar with kindness and truth. "Bind them around your neck. Write them on the tablet of your heart. So you will find favor and good repute," what? "In the sight of God and man." God and Potiphar. "Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him." But notice, it starts with obedience to the Lord's commands. Not letting kindness and truth depart from you. I've shared with you before how my current boss, when he became my boss, accused me of things that weren't appropriate, weren't things I was guilty of, wasn't fair, wasn't just, and spent 3 hours talking to him, trying to explain to him that most of what he was saying was not true. He docked my salary. It wasn't fair. It was unjust. And I'll tell you, I had to wrestle with kindness and truth. I didn't feel like being kind. I didn't feel like serving him. I felt like saying things that I'd probably regret. I had to make some decisions on how I was going to handle that situation. It wasn't easy. Amy will tell you. Verse 6, "In all your ways acknowledge Him." Who? The Lord. What does it mean to acknowledge Him? That's obedience and worship and recognition, fear, acknowledging the Lord, acknowledging the circumstances He's allowed you to be in. And He will make your paths straight. That's the promise in that situation. "Do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and turn away from evil." We're going to see Joseph have to do that in a moment. "It will be healing to your body and refreshment to your bones. Honor the Lord from your wealth." We're going to see Joseph do that. Not from his wealth, but he's going to honor the Lord. "And from the first of your produce. So your barns will be filled with plenty, and your vats will overflow with new wine. My son, do not reject..." And interestingly, he throws in discipline here as well. "My son, do not reject the discipline of the Lord." Why would he put that in this passage? Where he's talking about the Lord making your path straight, because sometimes discipline is a part of that. And discipline, we think, oh, you're getting spanked. Not necessarily. That's part of discipline. But discipline is just teaching and instructing you to walk in the way that the Lord wants you to walk. It's not always pleasant. Sometimes it involves circumstances and situations we don't understand. Why? So the Lord can teach us to walk and to live and to honor Him in those circumstances and situations. "For whom the Lord He loves, He reproves, even as a father corrects the son in whom he delights." Interesting, when we see Proverbs chapter 35, we love to quote verses 5 and 6. Trust in the Lord, trust in the Lord. But the context is obedience and discipline, trusting the Lord even in those times. So what's our takeaway with this? Well, God can cause us to succeed even when those circumstances or situations are unfair or unjust. Joseph chose to serve the Lord in those circumstances and situations that he was facing. And one of the principles that we find in the Bible, including Proverbs 3, 5, and 6, is that God blesses the work of our hands even in those circumstances and situations when we commit ourselves to serve Him and to serve others. He'll bless what we do. And again, it doesn't mean that we become rich. It doesn't mean that our circumstances always change. But when we find ourselves in a difficult situation or circumstance and we commit ourselves to serve the Lord in that situation and that circumstance, and we choose to serve those that maybe He's placed over us, we can be successful. And probably the greatest part of that success is what we see in Joseph and Potiphar, and that's Potiphar saw Christ or saw God in him. Saw that God was behind him. Really, isn't that where we ought to be? I think again about the situation with my boss. I had to think really seriously about what he would see when it comes to my relationship with Christ based on how I decided to behave. Because I realized that it wasn't so much that I needed my circumstances to change, but that instead I needed my boss to see Christ. Now, I believe he's saved. He goes to an evangelical church. That wasn't clear at the time. I don't know how mature he was or is. But it's led to some neat things. Our relationship is radically different today than it was back then. God honored all of that and used all that. And in fact, I will say this not to sound arrogant or proud, but God has made me successful to the point where I've even been rewarded from my boss and my boss's boss. That I think all goes back to that because I made that decision that I was going to serve him even when I thought it was unjust and I was being mistreated. And in the end, I believe that both my boss and my boss's boss could see the importance of my relationship with Christ in that, just like Potiphar did with Joseph. So it's not ultimately about our success. It's not about our. It's more about our witness, I think. And Potiphar seeing in Joseph that God was with him. Again, verse 3 says, "Now his master saw that Yahweh was with him and how Yahweh caused all that he did to succeed in his hand." So I think we should serve or seek to serve God even in the uncomfortable circumstances we may find ourselves in, even when they're unjust. Think about Christ. Think about the Apostle Paul. The guy died in a prison cell, beheaded probably. Think he ever faced injustice? But what did he do? Faithfully served, and as a result, I believe we're here because of Paul's ministry. We're all Gentiles. I think most of us are. Now, we're going to go on to the second part of this, which was that in this circumstance and situation, Joseph faced temptation, but he resisted that temptation. Look at verses 6 through 10. Actually, starting in verse 7, actually. Well, I'm sorry, the very second half of verse 6. It kind of stands out there all on its own. It's kind of a weird statement. But now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. That just kind of sticks out of nowhere, doesn't it? Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. It came about after these events that his master's wife looked with desire at Joseph. Well, now we know why that statement's there, right? She looked with him with desire. And she said, "Lie with me." So much for subtlety. But he refused and said to his master's wife, "Behold, with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house, and he has put all that he owns in my charge. There is no one greater in his house than I, and he has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do this great evil and sin against God?" As she spoke to Joseph day after day, he did not listen to her to lie beside her or be with her. So here we are at the peak of his success, and he faces temptation. In some respects, things were moving along as good as they could for a slave. He hadn't been released yet. That would have been better, right? To have his freedom. But let's just understand for a moment that things are going about as good as they could go for Joseph. And all of a sudden, he faces this temptation. It comes knocking at his door. We're told in verse 6 that he was beautiful, good-looking man. His stunning good looks were apparently too much for Potiphar's wife because she tries to seduce him. Not very subtle about it. It says that she looked with desire at him and she basically comes right out and says, "Lie with me." We know what that means. You know, years ago, I think I told you I got my job working for Chicago Title. To work primarily with realtors. I wasn't hired to be an IT person on staff to do IT work for them. We didn't have a wide area network or anything yet. So I was hired primarily to go out and work with realtors and to do some computer stuff with realtors, some software and stuff. And they're a strange breed. But there was this one particular, she was a fairly popular, famous, I don't know if you want to call it that, I'll say highly successful, well-known realtor in Columbus. And she worked out of her home. Her whole bottom basement was all, that's where she was and her staff and everything, you know. So I had to go out to realtors' homes and their businesses and install software and train them how to use this stuff and all of that. And so I went out to her place. And I have never in my life had somebody specifically make it really clear their sexual intent. This woman invited me to travel with her to Vegas and to do some things in Vegas together with her. I don't know how old I was. Was I 25, 26, Amy? I don't remember. I'm like deer in the headlights, you know, what is going on? And finally I looked at her and said, no, not really interested in that. And then she pushed even harder. Why not, you know? Finally, her husband's upstairs. I'm like, your husband is upstairs. And she's like, oh, he's fine with it. He knows. Talk about an uncomfortable situation or circumstance. Went back to my boss and said, no, I'm not going there again. I thought I was fine because, again, it was her business. Normally there'd be other employees there, you know. But talk about not very subtle, very blunt. That's kind of what Joseph is facing here. However, we're told that Joseph resisted and refused her advances not once, but repeatedly. Three times in these verses, the text refers to her as the wife of Joseph's master. So we're not just talking about sexual immorality here, we're talking about adultery. As serious as adultery would have been, Joseph also recognized that following through would have been a tremendous breach of faith and trust against Potiphar as well. So it wasn't just sexual immorality, but he recognized what he would be doing to Potiphar. Look back at verses 8 and 9 again. It says, he refused and said to his master's wife, behold, with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. And he has put all that he owns in my charge. There's no one greater in his house than I. He's withheld nothing from me except you, because you're his wife. How then could I do this great evil and sin against God? And so you see two things to hear. One is, he recognizes the sin that this would be against Potiphar. And again, it's not just that it's Potiphar's wife. That's bad enough. But the fact that Potiphar had trusted him, had put everything in his care, and he saw that as a tremendous breach of his relationship with Potiphar. I was reading an article this week about, was it Billy Joel? He just had to stop a concert series because of some brain issues he has. But I think it was Billy Joel. I'm thinking the connection there, but had an affair with a best friend. I was at Billy Joel, or am I conflating the two? But mentioned that almost committed suicide like three times. I think it was Billy Joel. And the thing, it was his best friend's wife. And so he thought, well, killing himself. I might be conflating that with another article, but I thought it might have been. But I just found that interesting. I'm kind of like, yeah, so his heart kept pricking him that he had done this to his best friend. So Joseph sees this here, but the thing that really catches my attention is that the way that he describes it at the end of verse 9, how could I do this great evil and sin against who? God. Who is at the heart and center of Joseph's time in captivity there? The Lord. He recognized this would be a grievous sin. I remember one time that I was in a counseling session when I was in seminary down at Faith Baptist down in Lafayette, and they were counseling a young man who had committed adultery against his wife, and he kept referring to it as an affair, and finally the counselor said, I've had enough of this. He said, you keep calling it an affair. It's not an affair. An affair is one of those fun things you do. He's like, this is adultery. This is wickedness. And the guy just kind of slunk down in his chair, you know. You could almost see him saying, well, that's a little bit harsh. Joseph doesn't sugarcoat it here. He calls it a great evil. He calls it a transgression, a sin against the Lord. Now, what's interesting about this to me is verse 10 tells us that even though she continued trying to seduce Joseph, he continued to resist. I like the way the NET translates this. They say, even though she continued to speak to Joseph day after day, he did not respond to her invitation to have sex with her. Even though. She didn't just try once. It says that it was a daily thing here. You know, if you can just wear him down, I'm sure that many of us are probably like me. It's sometimes easiest to resist temptation the first time. But, you know, if it just keeps staring you in the face, it becomes a little harder, and sooner or later you might feel like you get worn down. I was talking to Nick, was it last week, about ice cream. My vice is ice cream. Now here's the thing. I will buy a quart and a half of ice cream, telling myself I'll have one today, it's Sunday, and then I'll just wait until next Sunday to have more. But if it's in the freezer, I see that thing every day because I don't want to get my little waffles for my breakfast, and I see, and I know it's there. So what do you think happens to that quart and a half of ice cream? Does it last till the next Sunday and the next Sunday? Do you really think, in fact, Nick agrees with me on this, where two or three are gathered together with the Lord, okay, we're both witnessing, there's two witnesses here. There are not 12 servings in a quart and a half of ice cream. Are there, Nick?
No.
That's what the box says, or the container, but there's not. I do not do well if that temptation is standing there beating me down. Okay? If it's in the house, I'll eat it. So the best thing for me to do is to not get in the car and drive down the road to pick it up and bring it home, because I know when I buy it, it's not going to last for a couple of weeks. It's not going to have 12 servings in it. That's the way a lot of us are. Well, imagine Joseph day after day having this woman just say, hey, sleep with me. Sleep with me. Come on, just sleep with me. Nobody's going to know. Come on. But day after day, it says he continued to refuse. Why? Because he was convinced. This is a great evil. This is a great sin against Potiphar and against God. So what's our takeaway with this? What can we learn from Joseph? Well, temptation often comes when we least expect it. But remembering God's presence helps us to resist it. Remembering that this is an offense against Him. It isn't just right and wrong, it's an offense, a great evil against the Lord. I think that's one of the reasons why when we look around the church today, we see what's going on in the church today. People have forgotten what sin is. Even in the church, it's no big deal. You know what the instance of sexual morality within the church is today? It used to be that in my day, when I, you know, even as a kid, even unsaved couples, it was always sort of a scandal when they moved in together. Today, there are Christians in churches living together with absolutely no concern, attend church every Sunday morning, and even evangelical churches. How many of you have you guys heard about Michael Tate and Newsboys? What's been going on with that? Newsboys, probably one of the most popular Christian bands in American history. Michael Tate was a lead singer. Up until January, he resigned because somebody, some blog guy, posted a blog that said he was gay. Michael Tate was gay. Well, the next day he resigns from Newsboys. Doesn't say he was, but does tell his band members, hey, I'm living a double life. Well, it's just come out recently here that he has sexually assaulted a number of boys. But here's what was startling to me. As I read through the article, what was shocking to me are the number of people that knew about it in Nashville in the Christian music industry. But not only that, but about what they called the ugly underbelly of Christian music. The drug use, the sexual immorality, the parties. I mean, my stomach was churning as I was reading this. I'm like, what? And they're like, oh, this is just an open secret. Or this known within those circles. But even like on the Newsboys bus, if these people, these reports, and there's one of the main drivers was Julie Royce, and there's some stuff I don't always agree. She was with Moody Radio for a while, but sometimes her investigative reporting is really good, and she spent a lot of time interviewing people involved with the music industry and that. The drinking? I mean, I'm not somebody who says that to have alcohol is a sin. I don't do it myself. But I get that God gives us some liberty in things that we do, and Paul talks about meat sacrificed to idols and all that kind of stuff, and so I am willing to extend that. I don't choose to drink myself, but I'm not going to condemn a brother who decides to have a beer at home. That's if he wants to do that. However, I do think that there's things we should be careful with. Well, you know, some of the stories, even with some of the newsboys, are going out to the bars and getting trashed the night before concerts. I'm like, but what? I don't get that. Or cocaine on the bus. I don't get that. Now, we have to be careful. This is reports, but multiple people reporting the same thing. There are Christian artists who have left the Christian music industry saying the same things. We couldn't stay there because of it. It's a known fact that this stuff happens. Turns my stomach. We've forgotten what sin is. We've forgotten what transgressions are. We've forgotten that this is a huge offense. And so it's just sort of like, this is what we do. And so, hey, it's okay to do this. You know, because what's important is we get up on that stage and we worship and we praise and we lead people to Christ. It doesn't matter that, you know, after the concert's done, we're all sitting around drinking and getting drunk. And again, I'm not saying every artist does it. It's just that it's disturbing to think that even some of that happens in those circles. Why? We just become numb to it. And again, we look around what's happening in many evangelical churches today and the lives of the Christians who just behave like the world does for the rest of the week. And again, I'm not trying to stand up and puff up my chest and say I don't struggle. We all do. We know we all sin, right? We all face temptation. But God forbid we become numb to it. In Joseph's case here, think about it. How easy might it have been for Joseph in those circumstances to say, God, you've been unfair to me. I don't deserve to be here. Hey, nobody would know. I'm a single guy. Hey, the Bible even says I'm good looking. I'm handsome. Why not? What could go wrong? But Joseph didn't allow his circumstances or his success or the fact that, hey, I'm a good looking guy and she's interested in me. But even in that onslaught, her repeated daily attempts to seduce him, he resisted. Why? Because it was a great evil and a sin against God. That should be our model, should it not? When facing temptation, we got to remember, this is a great offense against God. And it happens when we least expect it. Why? We let our guard down. And that happens, I think, in two different ways. One is, when circumstances are not great and we're upset with the circumstances we're in, we let our guard down. When things are really going really well, remember Israel and the coming into the land, and you know, things are going great. We have the book of Judges. Every time things were going really well, what did they do? Let their guard down and start worshiping Baal. So it happens on both ends. It seems like the only time we really keep our guard up is when we're somewhere stuck in the middle. Things aren't great, but they're not terrible. But our radar's up. And so Joseph here faces temptation when least expected, and what does he do? He resists. This is at the heart and soul of what James says in chapter 4, verse 7. He says, submit. And James was dealing with a church that was in a mess. They were bickering and fighting. Somebody in the church had been murdered, it appears. The rich and the poor were constantly at odds. There was a lot of favoritism, you know, bad words, bickering, fighting. And James says, submit therefore to God. Resist the devil and he will flee from you. Draw near to God and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners. Purify your hearts, you double-minded. That's the heart and soul of it. Resist the devil. Submit to God. That's how Joseph handled temptation. Let's move on. Unfortunately now, doing the right thing, resisting temptation, honoring God, honoring Potiphar, cost Joseph dearly. Look at verses 11 through 12, chapter 39. Now it happened one day that he went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the household was there inside. She, Potiphar's wife, caught him by his garment, saying, lie with me. And he left his garment in her hand and fled and went outside. So she wanted what she wanted. She wasn't going to take no for an answer. She wasn't part of the Me Too movement, apparently. No didn't mean no. Didn't apply to her. So when her begging and pleading and everything else didn't work, she resorted to physically accosting him. He goes in one day. I imagine she made sure that nobody was there. None of the men were around, it says. And it says that she seized him, literally grabbed him by his garment, probably his outer garment. Demanded, lie with me. Again, no subtlety there. And Joseph does the only thing he could do at that moment. says that he left his garment in her hand. He fled. That literally means he ran away or he escaped. And it says that he went all the way outside. In other words, he got out of Dodge as quickly as he could. We're told in the New Testament, flee sexual immorality. Why? Because sometimes that's the only way to deal with it. Get out of there. Flee. And that's what Joseph did. Unfortunately, his commitment to doing the right thing and obeying the Lord cost him something. Look at what happens next, verses 13 through 20. It says, when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and fled outside, she called the men of her household and said to them, see, he has brought in a Hebrew, meaning her husband there. He, Potiphar, brought in a Hebrew to make sport of us. He came into me to lie with me, and I screamed. When he heard I had raised my voice and screamed, he left his garment beside me and fled and went outside. So she left his garment beside her. Oh, how convenient is that, right? Until the master came home. Then she spoke to him in these words, the Hebrew slave whom you brought to us came into me and made sport of me. And as I raised my voice and screamed, he left his garment beside me and he fled. Now when his master heard the words of his wife, which she spoke to him, saying, this is what your slave did to me, his anger burned. So Joseph's master took him and put him in the jail. We find out later that that's actually a pit that he was thrown into, prison in the floor. The place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in the jail. You're probably familiar with the saying, hell have no fury like a woman scorned. I had to look that one up. I've always heard it. It's actually from a play penned by William Congreve. It's called The Mourning Bride, and he was suggesting that there's no deeper hatred or rage than that of a woman who's been rejected by her lover. That kind of describes what we see here. She was not happy with Joseph, scorned. We don't know specifically if what she does next is to cover her own butt. Because how bad would it look? Her husband comes home and sees Joseph's robe kind of hanging there. Huh, wonder what happened here. So maybe she was covering her own behind, or maybe she was simply scorned and she was going to pay Joseph back for rejecting her affections. Notice that she even blames her husband. The Hebrew slave that you brought to us. Doesn't that sound like the garden? Lord, it's that woman you gave to me. She deceived me. Verse 19, this is what your slave did to me. So in spite of everything that Potiphar knew about Joseph, he still bought his wife's story. He still listened to his wife. Again, sound like the garden maybe? And so what happens? Joseph gets thrown into prison. How confusing, how frustrating, how depressing that must have been for Joseph. He goes through all the stuff with his family. Probably doesn't understand, what are you doing, God? I'm supposed to become a ruler. I'm supposed to reign. And here I am, a prisoner. But things are looking up. Hey, you're blessing me, Lord. Okay. I've become successful in Potiphar's house. Things are going really well. And now this? And oh, by the way, God, I did the right thing. I did what you wanted me to do. I didn't sin against you. I actually fled. And this is how I get repaid? I don't know about you, but I'd be struggling with that. Again, we don't see what Joseph is thinking here. But I think it's fair to imagine that he was probably going, Lord, what in the world are you doing to me? And again, this isn't just jail. We learn later that it's a pit. Now, he was in Potiphar's house. That's where the prison was, probably because he was the captain of the guard. But it was a pit. Dungeon is another way to describe it. So everything comes crashing down for Joseph here. And all he did was the right thing. Takeaway. Sometimes even though we do the right thing and obey God, we still face false accusations. We face injustice, unfair circumstances. I hate to say it this way, but sometimes that's just life. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 12. We're told in such circumstances to keep our behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds, as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. You notice what Peter is saying there? He's saying that when you face circumstances like this, when you're falsely accused or the world accuses you of doing things that you didn't do, that you're not guilty of, he doesn't say, well, keep your behavior good so that you can be exonerated. He says what? That they may see by your good deeds, and as they observe them, that they might glorify God in the day of visitation. Isn't that interesting? God says in those circumstances where we're falsely accused, to do the right thing anyway. Why? For the sake of them that watch our behavior. Ouch. The very people that are accusing us, it's for their benefit that they might see the deeds that we do. But there is another element to it, because in verse 15 he does say a little bit later here, for such is the will of God that by doing right you may silence the ignorance of foolish men. So sometimes behaving properly in those circumstances, honoring God in those circumstances, ultimately will exonerate us. It will silence the ignorance of foolish men. I had to think about that seriously when, again, I go back to this example with my boss. How might I prove that he was wrong? By walking out the door? If I did that, took another job somewhere, in essence, I'm saying he's right. At least in his mind. But I stuck it out. In the end, I believe that my behavior proved otherwise. In fact, it was interesting to see him get it in dealing with, a lot of it was related to what was happening out in Kansas with a very narcissistic manager. He now clearly sees, oh, it was the manager, it wasn't Mike. Much of what he had thought was true about me, he's convinced is not true. What this teaches us is that doing the right thing should serve as a form of protection against slander and false accusations, sometimes. But generally speaking, hopefully, others will see through that behavior that even in those unjust circumstances that we're honoring God, and they will see God in us and in what we do. We've seen it with Joseph, we saw it with Jesus, we saw it with the apostles, we've seen it for the past 2,000 years with Christians all over the world. We are treated unfairly and unjustly. So how do we behave in those circumstances and situations? We do the right thing. And maybe we pay the consequences for the right thing. That's hard though, isn't it? We'd like to wiggle our way out, maybe not have to, but Jesus himself warned us that we would be hated because he was hated. That's just life. We've been somewhat sheltered here in the United States because of that, or in spite of that. I don't think that's going to be the case for a whole lot longer. I don't think things are going to get better for us. I think they'll get worse for us here. They certainly are in the rest of the world. It's not getting better out there. So sometimes even though we do the right thing, we obey God, we still may face these false accusations. We may face uncomfortable circumstances. I wish I could blow some smoke and make it feel good. I wish... this is probably the one time I wish Joel Osteen was right. Your best life now! No. Not so much. Or the health and wealth and the prosperity preachers. That God just wants us all happy, healthy, and prosperous and, you know, rich. The last point that I want to make in this passage here, we find in the last few verses, 21 and 23, in spite of the injustice, in spite of Joseph paying the price for his commitment to Christ or commitment to God, God did remain faithful to him and showed him favor once again. Look at verses 21 through 23. But the Lord was with Joseph. But the Lord was with Joseph. I'm going to repeat that one more time. But the Lord was with Joseph. That's where it all began. Remember, it says that in the beginning of this passage? The Lord had not abandoned him, and extended kindness to him, and gave him favor in the sight of the chief jailer. The chief jailer committed to Joseph's charge all the prisoners who were in the jail, so that whatever was done in the prison there, he was responsible for it. The chief jailer did not supervise anything under Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him. The Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made to prosper. Did you notice the book ends there? The passage starts that way. That the Lord was with him, caused him to prosper. And we get this stuff that goes on with Joseph where it makes you wonder, really? Was the Lord really with him? Look what was going on. Now he's back in prison. But it reminds us that the Lord is still with him and the Lord is now causing him to prosper, even in prison. And again, it certainly wasn't financial prosperity or even a change in circumstances. Joseph took on the responsibility of caring for the other prisoners. Wow. That is a mentality that basically says, no matter where I end up, no matter where God places me, no matter how bad the circumstances, I am going to allow him to use me here. That is opposite of what we hear so often, isn't it? We beg for God to change the circumstances. We want out of it. It's not really fair. I don't deserve this, you know? But it appears that in Joseph's case, when he ends up in Egypt as a slave, he commits himself to serve the Lord as a slave. Then when he ends up in prison as a prisoner, he commits himself to serve the Lord as a prisoner and takes care of the other prisoners. And as we're going to see, God uses him. In fact, the thing we have to keep in mind with this is that this is the Lord's path for him. We're going to see how the fact that he's in prison is exactly what opens the door for him to ultimately go on and become ruler in Egypt. Had this not been the case, that might not happen. This was God's path for him. God was going to use all of it to accomplish what he had planned for Joseph. Joseph may not have seen it. How does this fit into your plan, Lord? You said I'd rule. I go to prison, or I go to Egypt, I become a slave, then I get accused of attempted rape, and I end up in prison. How in the world is this? Well, we'll see. It works out. It was God's purpose and plan. He took him down this path for a reason. And I think about us, no matter what the circumstance, no matter what the situation, God is still with us, and we should commit ourselves to serve God in that place, in that time. Now, just to be clear here, Paul even makes a statement that to slaves, he tells slaves in the New Testament to serve their masters, even the ones who aren't good to them. But he does say, but if you can seek your freedom, seek it. He's not saying us that we should never try to better our circumstances or ever try to get out of our circumstances. If I were falsely accused of something and they wanted to try me for it, you better believe I'd fight tooth and nail to prove my innocence. The Bible never tells us not to do that. But while we're there, should commit ourselves to serving the Lord and serving others as best we can. That's what we're called to, and that's exactly what we see here in Joseph. And as a result, he receives favor, both from God and from the jailer. So our takeaway on this is that when we face injustice for doing the right thing, God will not abandon us. He's still there. It may not feel like it with our circumstances, but he's still there. Again, how many times in this passage are we reminded God was with him? The circumstances changed drastically. From at home with his family to now in a prison. Circumstances were all over the map. But we are continually told throughout these passages the Lord was with Joseph. The Lord prospered Joseph. But we also see how Joseph committed himself to serving the Lord faithfully, resisting temptation, honoring God, honoring those around him, including Potiphar, and now honoring the prison guard. I think that's the model. I think that's what we're supposed to see in this. I want you to turn to one last passage because I'm reminded as I read through this of something Paul said. I had a conversation with my mentor, Pastor Krenz, this week. I called him. He's 96 now. I think he'll be 97 this year. Blown away the fact that he's in a assisted living place there. They have a apartment that they own inside this assisted living place, and then from there they can move to an actually assisted apartment, and then from there they can go into a nursing home. His wife's got dementia. She's not doing very well at all. He's caring for her. But this guy leads, he's 97, leads a men's Bible study on Tuesday morning with five guys in it, leads a men's Bible study on Wednesday morning with three guys in it, and leads a men's Bible study on Thursday morning with another guy in it. He's 97. He was a preacher, loves to preach, loves to teach, loves to mentor. What's he doing in this nursing home? God put him here. He's in a terrible situation, caring for his wife, who probably at this point may not even know who he is. He's still caring for her. How unfair is that? A man who's committed his life to serving Christ the way Pastor Krenz has. This is not fair. It's not just. But it's where God has him. And he's committed himself. And what God has done is these men that he meets with, they're not all from the home. They're coming in from the outside. God brought people to him to minister. Why? Because he was willing to minister. I think about Timothy and what Paul wrote to Timothy here. 2 Timothy chapter 4, we'll end on this. 2 Timothy chapter 4, verses 14 through 18. These are the last recorded words we have of the Apostle Paul. Chapter 4, starting at verse 14. Alexander the coppersmith did me much harm. The Lord will repay him for his deeds. Be on guard against him yourself, for he vigorously opposed our teaching. At my defense, no one supported me. All those people that Paul led to Christ, no one supported him. He's in prison here. But all deserted me. May it not be counted against them. But the Lord stood with me. The Lord was with me. And strengthened me so that through me, what? The proclamation might be fully accomplished. What is Paul concerned with? Not his circumstances, not the fact that the coppersmith had done him great harm, not the fact that nobody supported him, and in fact, not the fact that people had deserted him. Paul's concern is that the Lord has stood with me. Why? So that the proclamation of the gospel might be fully accomplished. And that the Gentiles might hear. And I was rescued out of the lion's mouth. The Lord will rescue me from every evil deed and will bring me what? Safely to his heavenly kingdom. To him be the glory forever and ever. Amen. Paul is not talking about release from prison there. Because earlier he says, I've already been poured out like a drink offering. This is it for me. He knew where he was going. He was going home. What does this tell us about our situation and circumstances here? Paul wasn't concerned about the circumstances. Wasn't concerned about the injustice, the unfairness. He was concerned with one thing, that the Lord was with him and that it would ultimately lead to the proclamation of the gospel. Folks, we got it backwards. We live in a fat Christianity where we think it's all about us, all about our own prosperity, all about our own health, our own wealth, our own feeling good and having all the stuff. What a mess. Paul wasn't worried about that. I don't think Joseph was worried about that. One of the things I talked with Pastor Krenz about is the thing he prays for me every single night. And what he prays is that I might be consumed with the gospel. That's his heart for me. That's his heart for himself. He just wants to see people saved. He wants to see people grow and mature in Christ. If anybody had a reason to be bitter or resentful, it would be him. Because I'm thinking, boy, that guy has changed more people's lives, including mine. He doesn't deserve where he's at all. But what's his focus right now? He's taking care of his wife and serving other people while he's in the circumstances he's in. He knows he's not going to be around much longer. He's much like Paul. He knows his parents both lived to 103 or 104. He's got a few good years left, I think. But may we all think like that. I love this part of the Joseph story. It's one of my favorite parts of the story. Because it just kind of reminds me of, so oftentimes we see the warts and all of some of the people. With Joseph, it's almost like God has said, I'm just going to show you the really, really good parts. I'm sure that Joseph struggled. But we just see this faithful, godly man who just continues to serve in his circumstances and situations, fights back against temptation, just continues to serve the Lord, and it says that the Lord is still with him. Amen?